everyone. My name is Aarti, and this is the Mahabharata. Episode 63, Lakes of Blood, Lakes of Youth, and Some Baby-Making Water. Also available online at www.themahabharatapodcast.com or facebook.com/themahabharatapodcast. To recap, we're in the third book of the Mahabharata. The Pandavas are in exile, Arjuna's in the heavens doing stuff, and to distract themselves from his absence, the rest of the group is on pilgrimage, guided by their priest, Lomash. Pilgrimage, you may know, is a special brand of tourism that involves sacred sites, sacred food, long bus trips with chatty companions, thieving monkeys, and a whack of sacred stories. And our heroes are going to hear literally hundreds, maybe thousands, in the third book. In our last episode, we started the story of Rishi Ram Jamadagnya, aka RJ, aka also Parshuram, a figure who pops up in many a Hindu text with his signature weapon, the axe. We learned of the less-known benefits of tree-hugging, as well as its untoward hazards. We saw a sweet Brahmin boy morph into a harshly jealous, homicidal husband. And we heard the shocking story of a mother executed by her own son. Renuka is subsequently revived, of course, to no memory of the events, and RJ himself has his memory erased, so avoiding a lifetime of awkward dinners. But we remember. Later tradition will have RJ as the sixth avatar of the god Vishnu, which, of course, is the logical culmination of a career involving matricide, mass murder, and regular hot spas in gurgling pools of blood. Like an emeritus position, you might say, or an honorary degree. RJ becomes a Chiranjeevi, a long-living or never-dying one, and I, for one, am much comforted knowing he's out there. But first, let's see how he gets there. Post-matricidal events, life in the RJ household reverts to normal. Cooking, cleaning, shoveling snow. The family has some rattling skeletons, but who doesn't, right? All's back to business until one day a special visitor happens by, a certain king named Kartavirya. Let's call him KV for short. We'll give him a 2 on our must-remember scale because, though he's a recurring presence, we know very little about him. But chances are, if you met him in a back alley, you'd remember him. He's got some distinctive features, you see, 998 of them to be precise, which is to say he's got 1,000 arms. That's right, 5,000 nails to chew upon when you're anxious, 1,000 buttons to fumble with, a million micro-decisions about which hand brushes teeth, which holds fork and knife, which combs hair or plays tennis. Don't ask. So King KV pays the RJ household a visit. Mid-morning one day, Mother Renuka's home-prepping lunch, long neck betraying no scars of recent decapitation, when the doorbell rings to announce the king. This is not a social call. The king is visiting for a specific purpose, though there are disparate theories about what that might be. One line of analysis has it that there's a row pertaining to a special quadruped the Brahmin family denied the king. You know, a la the Vasishta Vishvamitra saga we discussed eons ago, in which King Vishvamitra lusted after Rishi Vasishta's wondrous wish-fulfilling cow. But if you're incredulous that there should be multiple fantastical dairy cows in the universe, or that bovine envy could possibly instigate the calamitous train of events to follow, there's another theory you might find persuasive. This is that the previous king, that would be a thousand-armed wonder's daddy, had been a pious sort of character, wont to giving generously to Brahmins. We're not talking little bursaries and scholarship programs. We're talking stupendous wealth of the bankrupt the kingdom variety. Toward the end of his life, King KV Sr. donated so magnanimously, he drained the entire treasury. As they watch truckloads of gold hurtling down the highway, his children are furious. So roughly 30 seconds after the king dies, his successor, KV of the Thousand Arms, makes it his mission to reclaim the kingdom's wealth. And he's not inclined to be nice about it. No tax notices or special levies, no. He mobilizes the military to seize Brahmin assets and comes personally knocking at the Bhargava's door. When Renuka answers, he shoves past her, then proceeds to ransack the house. He's got 1,000 arms, so imagine the efficiency. 30 seconds flat, he's broken chairs, shattered china, kicked down pillar and post. Then he heads to the shed. They have a dairy cow, most precious to the family. He tears its nursing calf violently away, and as the calf lows piteously, he throws it into the carriage and blasts off, leaving a billowing cloud of dust behind him. When RJ returns home, whistling a merry tune, he's greeted by a sight of pillage. His mother's collapsed in shock. The rafters of the house are flapping in the wind, the structures teetering precipitously. His father acquaints him with the day's events. Now, our boy's a bit of a hothead. We've established this already. Hearing about the king's rampage, RJ is furious. How dare he violate our space, breaking and entering, property damage, larceny. Whatever the legally pertinent description, he determines to go after him. Following the king is not hard. There's a trail of detritus leading directly to him. RJ confronts the king on the highway. You think you're king, so you can do whatever you want? Not today, not with me. The king whips around, prepared to obliterate the little upstart, but one strike, and RJ cuts off his arm. Then 2, 3, 4, and 20 in a blizzard of arrows, he severs every last one of King KV's 1,000 arms. Now, I know what you're thinking, and frankly, I'm with you. A mite reckless, maybe? Granted, you're upset, but is mutilating the royal person really the most considered course of action? And I know the more pragmatic among you are doing the further calculus. Well, if you're going to hurt him, don't leave him alive, for Pete's sake. Have you never watched a Hollywood film? You finish him off, and then you run, because chances are there's no good end for you. But RJ's proud and unconcerned about consequences. This is an epic showdown between church and state, so to speak. Who wields greater power? And he wants the message out there loud and clear. Brahmins aren't going to take it anymore, kind of thing. The bloodied, mangled body of the king will be a billboard to the world. Don't mess with Brahmins. Only, things don't go quite as RJ might have desired. As the king is presumably rushed to hospital and surgeons presumably get busy trying to, presumably unsuccessfully, reattach limbs, events unfold exactly as we imagined they would. There's no need for a manhunt. RJ's made no attempt to disguise his identity and there's no dearth of witnesses. Instead, he returns home in triumph to share the news with the family. He doesn't put up fortifications, he doesn't dig any bunkers, no explosive tripwires secure the property. RJ has lunch, then goes about his errands as usual. When he returns a couple hours later, his father's dead. King KV's sons arrived just minutes after his departure, when RJ's dad, Jamadagni, refused to give up his son's whereabouts, they cut off his head. Arjay's name was still on his lips when he died. If it were not a time of sorrow, we might whisper about the poetic symmetry between Jamadagni's decapitation of his wife and his own sorry fate. Arjay's grief knows no bounds. Returning home to the carnage, he weeps over his father's body. Cradling his head, he cries, "It's my fault. I did this. I left you alone to face those brutes. How did you deserve it? An old man offering no resistance. What manner of degenerate hurts a pious man unresisting?" But there's no balm that heals the wound of death. And eventually he pulls himself together to perform the last rites for his father. Where his mother and brothers are, our text doesn't tell us. But as the flames consume his father's body, they seem to enter into his own being. There will be vengeance, there's no doubt about that. But Arjay is going to do more. He's going to rid the world of Kshatriyas. Hardly have the ashes cooled, then Arjay begins his campaign of retribution. Axe in hand, he swings indiscriminately and anything that even smells like a Kshatriya. With chilling determination, he butchers his entire generation of Kshatriyas. When the widows rebreed and repopulate the earth, he slaughters the next generation as well, and then the next and the next. 21 generations he kills, man and child, emptying the earth of the warrior class. He fills 5 lakes with their blood. And to go full on Tarantino, he immerses himself in these lakes and proceeds to make daily offerings to his ancestors with blood. Finally, his ancestors, watching all this from the heavens, decide he needs help. They remonstrate with him to stop. But no amount of therapy can quell Arjay's hatred for Kshatriyas. He'll stop the genocide, but his rage will continue to simmer and periodically erupt. As it will one day, we'll see, over Kunti's firstborn, Karna. So now we've cleared the cobwebs on why he'd be an avatar of Vishnu. We can say goodbye to Arjay, at least for the moment. But first, let's consider this. The 5 grisly lakes he creates will eventually become the site for Kurukshetra, the site of the Mahabharata war. Which is to say, the land that will see some 18 million Kshatriyas hack each other to bits has already been steeped in Kshatriya blood many times over. But let's move on to happier things, shall we? And what could be happier than a wedding, also in the family of Bhrigu, of a figure by the name of Chyavan? Remember him? Perhaps not. He was only just a slippery newborn, but you might recall his mum, the haughty Puloma, who was scandalously assaulted while in an advanced state of pregnancy by the improbably similarly named Rakshasa, Puloman. That might be episode 5, 6, 7, somewhere in there. The music was loud, the crowds heaving. In the violent tussle, the baby had tumbled out of his mother's womb, creating a splash and earning himself the name Chyavan, the one who fell. It's this babe we're meeting today, now to celebrate his nuptials. What he's been up to all these years, we don't quite know. But at curtains, Chyavan is already long of tooth, been engaged in austerities for so long, people have rather forgotten he exists. At least, that's what we might reasonably extrapolate, given he's been in no way to entertain friends. He has a tree in the woods, you see, where he's been sitting rigid as a post in the Virasana for literally years, maybe decades. Seasons come and seasons go. Creepers weave around him. His hair becomes matted, his body caked with dirt, until he literally becomes a giant anthill. Insects burrow in and out his orifices. Birds perch on his head. But so collected and ascetic is he that he's quite unperturbed by anything around him. All that changes one day when a certain king visits the wood with a gaggle of some 4,000 women in his retinue. Why does the king need 4,000 women? Well, as with everything in life, it's all about a delicate balance. 3,999 is too few, and 4,001 would put a strain on resources. In any case, one among them is his lovely young daughter, Sukanya. Slender, spirited, with the fresh exuberance of a teenage girl. One glimpse of her, and the anthill falls in love. He might be 100 by now, or less, or more, who knows, but observing the young girl at play with her friends, he experiences the first stirring passions of a teenage boy. So much so that for the first time in forever, he opens his mouth to speak. But he can't, of course. Mounds of compressed dirt have glued his mouth shut. All he can manage is a few grunts, and these he makes desperately. Startled at the sound, the girls investigate. The anthill has two bright buttons that seem to almost move. Curious, Sukanya pokes the button with a twig. Ow! Poked in the eye, Jevon gets so angry, he curses the king's army with a curse we can only imagine from a teenage boy. Constipation. What it lacks in drama, however, it makes up in sheer miserable discomfort. As distended bowels render his army basically useless, the king investigates and learns his troops have been cursed. But why? Who's done what? Tentatively, his daughter confesses. It might have been me, Dad. I saw what I thought was a firefly disappear into this anthill. I tried to poke it out. Do you think that might have triggered it? The penny drops in the king's head. Not wasting a moment, he speeds over to the anthill and prostrates before him. I'm so sorry. My foolish girl injured you in play. She's an innocent child. Please forgive her. Rishi Chavan now strains mightily to unglue his mouth and finally responds with earth-encrusted lips. I'll forgive her on one condition. She must be my wife. Afflicted army on one side, nubile daughter on the other. What, dear reader, would you do? With the dispatch of a Vegas wedding, Sukanya is married to the anthill. Alone in the woods now with her geriatric groom, Sukanya accepts her fate with dignity. She'd made the mistake. It's only fair she pay a lifetime's price for it. She chisels the dirt off her husband, looks after his every need, dutifully following his directions in this ramshackle shed that's now her home. Now, I know what you're thinking, and frankly, the gods are thinking it too. One day, as the young girl is bathing in the river, the twin gods, the Ashvins, ogling her nude form emerging from the water, are astonished to learn she's the wife of Rishi Chavan. That fossil? How could your father do it? A pretty young thing like you? It's scandalous. The gods get scheming. Look, a heavenly creature like yourself, blazing like lightning, should not be with that dried up tree bark. It offends the order of things. Choose one of us. We will teach you the arts of love. The Ashvins, you remember, are the twin gods of health and beauty, fathers of the Pandava twins. I'm thinking Hrithik, Eternally 25, or Charlie Hunnam in Sons of Anarchy, or Omar Burke in Agala. But Sukanya is not looking for trouble. Thanks, but you see I'm married, right? But the gods are persistent. Look, this isn't fair to you. You deserve better. Here's what we're going to do. For your sake, we'll transform your husband into a rock star. You pick the dude, we will make him, whoever tickled your fancy. He'll be young and beautiful, worthy of you. No strings, we promise. Sukanya is doubtful, but they reassure her just as a kindness. It's upsetting to see a sweet thing like you with a relic like that. Sukanya is quite certain her husband's too enlightened to concern himself with trivialities like appearance. But surprisingly, Chavan is able to set aside his ascetic qualm. Bride and groom are now equally content with each other. If you, dear reader, would transform your spouse into Hrithik, I'll post the particulars on the website. Our next story requires a short preamble, and I'm glad you're sitting down, because so far we've encountered what are arguably some oddities. Talking lizards, half-sliced babies, thieving snakes. But have you ever seen a man give birth? Yes, to a real live human infant. That is the wonder of one King Yuvaneshvar, who we'll meet next time and likely never see again. King Yuvi is an all-around great guy. His kingdom's flourishing, there's a healthy trade surplus, he's diligent and sacrificed, donates in good measure, people are compliant. In short, all is well in his world. All is well, that is, except for one tiny thing, which is that, notwithstanding many years of marriage, he has no children. No idea why. What might a man do to have a child? And in the story after that, what might a man do to have another child? Let's find out next time if you'll join me for another episode of the Mahabharata.